Hello, I'm Kitin from Grenoble, France, and I'm with...
I'm Michel Hacker, also from Grenoble, France, and yeah, happy to be back together in Stockholm.
In Frederick's apartment.
Exactly.
Welcome, Kitin and Hacker. You're back with your third album. Mm-hmm. The first one was called First Album, it came out in 2001. The second one was called Two, came out in 2009, and the new one called Third Album is out now after a 13-year-long wait. Mm-hmm. How did you get back together?
I think we started to work again together because we were bored of being alone and separated. We felt it was the right time to make music again. We wanted to, actually. It was not a plan or, yeah, you know, like, it's a long time, we didn't do anything, blah, blah, blah. No, we just felt like it was the right time. And we had ideas, so that's how it started.
Was this a bit of a pandemic project, or did you start before that?
No, before. We started just a little bit before, around Christmas 2019. And then pandemic happened around March 2020. So yeah, we started just a little bit before, yeah.
Yeah, we had already a few tracks ready. And also we had several gigs together as DJs. And we always have so much fun. And we talked about like getting back together and that touring together would be fun. And then when it's like that, he starts composing tracks kind of for us. Mm. And yeah, that's how it happened.
How does that work? Do you both work on the like musical tracks? Or
We worked different ways depending on the album. The first album we worked in a certain way. We were always like together in the studio. I mean, the studio, my bedroom back then. And then, so the first album was made like this. The second album we worked totally separately. I was making the music and Caroline was doing the lyrics and vocals. And on this one, it was half and half. We did some tracks like we used to do, so at my studio. And we did, and other tracks, we did it like separately. I was making the music, sending the music to Caroline, and she was working on it on her own. So it's a mix, yeah.
Yeah, but mostly we know each other so well. Michel is in charge of the music. I'm in charge of the lyrics and vocals, of course. He interferes in my lyrics. Mm. I ask him for help or inspiration when I'm stuck, and same for the music. And then we still need to finalize the tracks
together
separately.
Yeah, I mean, we finalize. Sorry.
Yeah, no, because he has to, you know, make the arrangement and the sound design on his own. And I still need to record the vocals clearly on my microphone and do all the research about effects and delays and all that stuff. And then I send him all the vocals finished, comped, treated, and ready to pass on the instrumental. So yeah,
what
that's
I wanted to say is that we did the final mix in another studio in the south of France at a friend's place.
For the first time, yeah.
For the first time. So the final mix, you know, to do the right EQ and everything in a real studio, we were all together.
Together, yeah. Was great.
Where do you live these days?
I'm still in Grenoble, but half Grenoble, half Lyon, with my girlfriend, which is like an hour away from Grenoble. But basically, I didn't really move.
And you're still in Berlin?
No, I left Berlin in 2006 to come back to France. I lived in Paris, and 5 years ago, so 2016, now 7 years, I moved to the countryside, in 1.5 hour away from Paris. It's not very far, but in a total remote place.
Yeah, where you have horses, right?
I have one horse.
One
that's
horse.
Enough. And my studio as well. My first proper real studio. So it's very convenient. Yeah.
What's your horse's name?
Grace.
Grace. Do you still go out clubbing? even if you're not DJing?
We did recently.
Yeah, yeah.
Somehow.
I mean,
where did you go?
Clubbing?
No, we played at Berghain.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We and played we were Berghain. Really serious, sober, and taking like our time to be focused for the show that we will, the kind similar show we will play tonight. And after, we went downstairs to have a drink, and honestly, it was our first real party together.
Since a
very long time, like drinking, talking to tons of friends, staying till like 6:30, not really remembering everything, but we really enjoyed ourselves, especially after the show, to enjoy being in this club and also like performing the song in this club was so joyful. I mean, Michel, I told him after a few tequilas that I was very happy and very proud of what we did, because after 30 years to have that joy and that to reach that level of friendship and you know connection is pretty amazing. And I think we kind of celebrated that the other night.
Well, also the thing is like, and I think it's a good thing, is that just before we played, we were still like super nervous, like beginners. And I think it's a good thing, because once, if one day you're not nervous anymore or scared, not scared, nervous before playing, it means that you're bored and it's over, you know. And we were very, I was very, thinking of everything, what I have to do, remembering everything. So was good, it's good energy. Mm. So this track is from Electronome, a Dutch artist on the Vulex label, and for us it's a kind, it's an old one, but it's great, you know, it's a classic for us.
It's actually on Interference.
Interference, yeah, but it's the same family, let's say.
Yeah, it's called One Drum Computer, One Synthesizer.
Yeah, that's enough.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What kind of fashionable and annoying man is your new song "Homme à la mode" about?
Oh, actually, we got this idea because
I was stuck.
Yeah, she couldn't find.
I didn't know. It's the last track. Yeah. I didn't know what to do. So
I had the music, very Liaison Dangereuse style. It's the
oh, I love Liaison Dangereuse.
But this track is my 650 attempt to copy Liaison Dangereuse. Anyway, so I liked and but she, yeah, Caroline was stuck with the lyrics. She was like, I don't know. She tried something, but
it didn't
work. And then there is this TV TV show called Flight of the Conchords.
I don't know if you know. It's really funny.
Yeah, I love it. And in one episode, you know, they do songs in every episode. And in one episode, they do a kind of pastiche of electroclash. And there is this track called Fashion is Danger. It's cool
very
name.
Cool.
And in this song, which is very good, and at some point he say, I am the man à la mode, which is l'homme à la mode in French. And so I said to Caroline, I like it. It's funny. And let's do a pastiche of a pastiche of a, you know, like talking about fashion and stuff like that. And that's how it happened.
But then when he tells me a word like that, I immediately make the connection, like, how can I take that further? What does he tells me today, l'homme à la mode? It's Flight of the Conchords for him, but for me, it's like, wait a minute, men fashion came to the same level as woman fashion. So now in fashion weeks in Paris, you have both. You have men and women walking the catwalk together, and they are pushing this men fashion a lot to a point that I'm taking a piece of that business in a way.
It's interesting when a parody becomes, you know, really, you know, good for real, when it's not just funny, but actually a good track.
Yeah. No, but the actual track from Flight of the Conchords is really good. Maybe and better than most of all the electroclash stuff that was 20 years ago. Anyway, but yeah,
and
that's where we
pretended to be serious.
Yeah, pretending to be serious.
But yeah, the parody was better. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
I'm very fond of your song Malade, which seems to be about how romantic ideals make people physically and mentally ill. How did you come up with that idea?
That's a risk I took to sing in French, but that's one of the main thing to motivate myself to try things I've never done before. Singing in French like that on a serious matter was one of them. So I wrote this, and I was really unsure about Michel's response. But I really wanted to speak about something more serious than, you know, suck my dick, kiss my ass 20 years ago. And then I sent him the track, and I was really surprised he loved it, you know, because usually when I get serious, political, or like too first degree, it's never so good. But this one has no irony at all. It's maybe the only track that has no irony at all. So
is it based on your own experiences, like being a victim du romantisme?
I am, for sure. I think we all are. But it's also inspired by what I see, what I read. You know, the people speak out about their traumas, about Me Too and so on. And that's what stands out for me, that women are always waiting for the charming prince. Since you're very young, you get to read fairy tales. And it's kind of a propaganda that doesn't work today. But it's so imprinted in ourselves that we don't even see it, you know. And also, it's part of our emancipation, men and women. That's very important that I speak about both. It's not a, you know, manifesto for feminists. I think we are both suffering from from a fact that we have to reinvent the way we envision relationships, because the old model doesn't always work.
And people go on Tinder and they always want something better. They never know, you know, should I be satisfied or should I, you know, find someone else?
And you just
keep scrolling.
Yeah, exactly.
On your last solo record, you left out the miss and you became Kitten.
In fact, I realized that on our first EP in 96, my name on the record is Kitten.
Oh,
yeah.
And then my first business card, I tried to have a business card when I started DJing. It was trendy to have a business card. It was also Kitten. But then promoters in France put me in front of every female DJ, and somehow people started to call me Miss, and I never got really rid of it until I realized that, I don't know why I should still be a Miss at 48 years old. I don't want to be a Miss anymore. I never wanted to be a Miss. And it's a way also to...
Right now, I remember like those parties in France, especially south of France.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about it right now. Those stupid promoters like putting Miss on every girl's name.
Yeah.
Miss this, Miss that, Miss blah blah, Miss. It was so, yeah.
The only one that never got the Miss was Electric Indigo.
She's also...
because she had a name that was not... has no genre.
Cool name.
How did Kitten come about from the start? Where did you get that?
It's kick into something. Kitten.
It's kick into something.
Yeah.
Un coup de latte.
Ah voilà, c'est ça, déjà à l'époque. It's a kick with big boots. But, and of course, yeah, my mother always called me in French Kitten. So it was like a good kick. But people misspell it still as Kitten, but no.
what about Hacker? Were you like a hacker for real, or was it from the Jeff Mills track?
Of course. No, I'm not. It was, you have to put that back in context. It was the early 90s, so I didn't really care about being a hacker. I didn't even know what it really meant, but it's just this Jeff Mills track. And
Jeff Mills.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and because before that I was in a band, a duo, making like hardcore techno, and we split, and then I had to find, it was cool to have a name back then, like a name, you know. And so I was already a big Jeff Mills fan, and I had this, it's on his first album, We're From Transmission, Volume 1, and there is this track called Hacker, The Hacker. And I was like, yeah, it sounds good, sounds cool, sounds mysterious, and blah, blah, blah.
But it still sounds cool.
Yeah, but I don't know.
It's good.
Let's listen to it.
Yeah, it's pretty hard.
I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You were both involved in the techno scene in France in the 90s. I remember there being like a real hostility towards electronic music mm-hmm. in France, which there was in the UK and Sweden as well. People were talking about how many drugs there were, but... What are your most vivid memories from that time?
The police caught me.
They did?
Yeah. Yeah, we were... Actually, Caroline was in another... There were two crew, let's say, organizing raves in the early 90s in Grenoble. I was part of a crew named Atomage. Mm. And Caroline was kind of in a Swift Turtle, you know, with the art.
Yeah, but
people.
But we were not organizing. You were organizing.
Yeah, I was part of it. And I was, and then we did one in the forest, and we didn't know that this particular forest spot was like protected. And the police came.
Like a national park or something?
Kind of, yeah. And so the police came and they caught me and Jeff, a friend of mine, and we went to the police station for several hours. And then they caught me a second time. I mean, they not really caught me, but they stopped a big rave and I was here again playing. And I went two times at the police station. So this was real. You know, we had to pay for a fine.
A fee.
So they didn't put me in jail or what. But still, so it was a real thing. And many times we had parties canceled by the police and stuff like that. But it was the mid-90s. The repression was very strong.
So that was before there was like an internet that people actually used. Did you have to like phone secret phone numbers?
You have an info line.
In record stores.
In record stores, yeah.
You had flyers with a number. You would call. Usually it was like a public phone, like a cabin, you know. And there was an answering machine saying, from 11
till 2 at this gas station or in the middle of nowhere, and then follow the
or the parking of a hypermarket in the suburbs, or an exit of a highway, and then there were cars and cars and cars, and you would have to wait for the leader who would bring you to the secret location. That was so exciting. We loved it.
It was part of the whole driving, the looking for the party, and then when you found it, you can hear the sound from far away.
And you're getting so excited to have excited. Drove so long, and it was part of the experience of freedom of was amazing.
I once spoke to Gabi Delgado López from DAF, Deutsche Mechanische Freundschaft, and he had this theory that France was more conservative with electronic music than other countries, because according to him, the socialist French newspaper L'Humanité once described DAF as fascist fistfuckers.
Yeah, and I know the story. Actually, Robert Gore told me this story, but I mean, I was young, but during the 80s, I was too young to go out and everything. But I still have the magazine from that time. And there were the French music magazines, they were really against electronic music. They didn't like Depeche Mode.
Even rock and folk and those like.
Of course, that's what I'm talking about. Those magazines.
The big ones.
I remember the big ones. And they were like saying that electronic
it's
not music, blah blah blah. And even a big band like Depeche Mode, it took years for them to be recognized as a main act. You know, so of course a band like DAF, but Front242 had the same needs. And they didn't understand the imagery, so for them it was like fascist, blah blah blah. But French magazines, they were really and it's the same people who said that techno was not music, and techno was fascist music for gay people on drugs, selling drugs. That was
fascist music for gay people
drugs. Exactly.
What's not to like?
it's exactly what we have.
Totally
they were,
antinomic,
yeah,
right?
Because they didn't know what they were talking about, you know. And it's the same people who disliked the electronic music in the 80s who also dislike techno and rave culture when it happened in the early 90s. So Gabby was right, totally.
But it's very representative of, in a way, of a certain French spirit, very attached to traditions, to what they created, and everything that comes from abroad, they reject it, you know?
And especially with the music, French, there was always a kind of I don't know how to say, but you know about electronic music in the 80s and even later, French people wanted to be rock, you know, guitars. But we are the worst for that. We are good. French people, we are good in chanson. You know, chanson like old Jacques Brel, Serge Gainsbourg, blah, blah, blah. We are good for this, and we are good for dance music. Disco in the 70s. And techno in the 90s. We are not good for rock. And all those rock people, they were the people who were in the main media and magazines. So that's why they were always saying, this is shit, it's not good, blah, blah, blah. But then again, when Daft Punk, you know, went so big, they just had to
surrender.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, you're better, and it was something typically French. We were not trying to copy the British or the Americans. It was our own thing. So, they were wrong. We are right. This is Hypnotist, House is Mine. It's a rave classic that we heard like so many times.
And we still play.
And we still play it, yeah.
You guys first meet, the very first meeting?
I don't even remember.
I think it was in a club, a club that used to be a new wave club in Grenoble called Le Magique. But then they changed the name, it was called Factory, like every techno club in the early 90s. And I think that's where we met, I think, around 91 or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and we went to our first rave party together because some DJs who came to that Factory club, the first like techno DJs, they gave us flyers. First time we saw a flyer, they were like, we do a rave in a city nearby in next month. A rave? What is that? Oh, you have to come. Okay, so we were maybe 10 people. 10 friends in two cars who drove to that rave. So it's basically our first rave party experience was in a smaller city, not that far. And we were blown away. And then after that, We were so blown away, we couldn't go home. So we went to an after hour in a small village, and it was election day. So there was like the small village, there was a little city hall, which was basically a house. And under the city hall, there was like twice the size of your living room. There was this room.
People dancing. Like.
And people dancing on repetitive music while all people were voting just the floor on
upstairs,
the main floor.
Yeah.
And they would hear this crazy music they've never heard before come down and see crazy kids with a strobe dancing like maniacs. Imagine. Yeah. It must have appeared to them like a mental institution. And we stayed in this place for hours, and I think we came back
later.
Like, I think I arrived home, it was after 8 p.m., because my mom was working in an election office, and she just screamed because I didn't vote. I didn't go vote, I arrived too late. Because offices like bureau close at 8. And she gave me such a hard time. I packed some stuff and I left home.
She got that angry?
Exact same day.
Did she want you to vote for like a special candidate, or was it just, you know, your lack of voting that got her upset?
Yeah, my lack of voting, but more, I think she was very involved in politics, my mom. And she was ashamed that as a, you know, a political involved person, her own daughter didn't show up. But I couldn't explain her what I just experienced. It was like two worlds. And also, like, I was very rebellious at the time. And I said, you know what? I bother you, I'm going to take my stuff and I'm leaving. So I went to live with a friend for a couple of years, and it was the only private flat that we had around. So Michelle and all the friends often came to this apartment to listen to Belgian DJ tapes, and there we started really going to every single rave.
Have you always been just friends, or have you ever been like a couple?
Never.
Always friends. No, not a couple.
We're never a couple.
Happened.
Never. Yes. No, I think we are too different, but that's our strength, that we are so different.
I think, yeah, because in music, there were a lot of couple making music, but when the couple end, the music end, like Eurythmics.
It's like Sonic Youth or Eurythmics.
Eurythmics, when they were together, the music was great. When they split, something was gone, you know. So we are protected from that.
Yeah, and also we started making music because basically I needed him. I was asked to do a compilation, a track for a compilation. He was the only one I knew who had machines. And then so our collaboration started from like joining forces somehow, but not because of a relationship. And I think we kept that all the way. We still need each other, which is great, you know.
You were a ballet dancer for almost your entire childhood.
It's another obsession of my mother.
Really? Politics and ballet.
No, I think she will never listen to that show, so I can tell, but she... I think my mom always had like bourgeois ambitions while we grew up in social buildings. So she was always hanging around kind of French bourgeoisie. So being in politics was a way to hang out with local, you know, rich people. I think she wanted to meet like a doctor or someone in politics to elevate socially. But of course, never happened. So she put me in ballet. And I did for 17 years.
Incredible. 17 years?
Yeah.
But did you enjoy it?
Yeah, because I think too much. So having to focus on something that precise really helped canalize my energy. And also they forced me, the discipline was really hard. And they forced me to go like twice a week or three times a week until I was 22. I kept on going until I was 22. So sometimes, like, we went to raves and I was still doing ballet, which is crazy. I never
thought about that. Yeah, it's hard to imagine, you know, two styles of dancing that are more different than, like, rave moves and ballet.
Believe me, I was a punk ballet ballerina.
You were a punk ballerina.
I was smoking. I cut my hair. I was not flexible, so I could never do, like, the super extravagant moves, but I was strong. I could turn and stuff. I was strong on points, but but it represents well the fact that you can do something that conservative and still be completely punk in a way. It represents me very well, actually. You know, I have both sides. I like to fuck things from inside, you know what I mean? Somehow.
Michelle, did your parents want you to do something else than music? Or
ballet?
Did they, like
ballet?
Not necessarily ballet.
Not ballet. No, not really. I think, my parents are really cool. Because I'm coming from let's say working class environment, not a rich family. And I remember when I decided to stop going at the university and make music as a living.
De la quoi?
I was inhalating a lot of solvents back then. So.
Yeah. He was very punk.
Yeah, I was kind of. But but when I said to my parents, I want to make music, I will always remember my father and my mother telling me, okay, you can stay at home, you can stay here, we don't, you know, put you out, but you have to, if you want to go out, if you want to buy your clothes and things and blah, 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 you have to work, you know. So I was like, yeah. But they were really, yeah.
They were cool.
They were really cool.
Did you have any day jobs in the beginning?
I had a lot. You know, but I'm lazy, so I was like always. I was just working for the amount of money I needed, so I was working like 1 month here, and then for 6 months nothing, and then again 1 month. So I did everything. I worked in restaurants. In I was selling Christmas tree.
I went to visit him when he's
actually selling Christmas tree is the is the last real job I did before we made a living with music.
Were you good at it?
Not really. No, kind of. Yeah.
What are the necessary skills that you need as a Christmas tree salesman?
You have to speak to people, and for me back then it was difficult to speak to, you know, people like selling a tree. I didn't care. I was like, yeah, are you selling Christmas tree? Yes, I am. There is like trees everywhere. What do you think I'm doing here? You know, I was not a good seller. Not really good.
I remember where people were like, what do you think, this one or that one? Isn't this one like more fluffy? Or and he was like, it's a fucking Christmas tree, you know.
But it's a
and
good
then,
school.
You know,
putting I had to
a
cut.
Nail. Yeah. Like
not a lot of people know that, but yeah, I did sell Christmas tree. Yeah.
This is Sabres of Paradise, Smoked Bledge, in memory of Andrew Weatherall.
Did you work with him at any point?
Oh, we met him, but many times.
Andrew?
I never worked. No, I mean me never.
No, we never worked together. But he's so vivid in my memories because The thing is, I moved to Geneva just about when we released Frank Sinatra, like 96. And my friends in Geneva were obsessed with UK music, Warp, all that stuff. And their god was Andrew Weatherall. But Andrew didn't want to fly at that time. He was scared of flying. And finally, for some reason, he said, yes, okay, I'm coming. So it was like revolution in town. Andrew is finally coming. And this party was incredible. Really, like, I'll never forget that night. And the next day, so my boyfriend had a record store where I was also working. And we just released Frank Sinatra. So he asked me to take care of Andrew and his agent, take them for lunch. So I spent the afternoon with Andrew. And then I had a gig, like a small gig somewhere. So we drove together to the airport and I had to board before him. So I said, nice meeting you, I have to go. He's like, where are you going? I'm like, yeah, well, I have a gig. Oh, you're a DJ. Yes, what's your name? And he flipped out. The girl from like the Frank Sinatra track, oh my God. And for us, like when I told Michelle as well to have such a feedback so early, we never imagined people knew this record, you know. It was like the real beginning of our popularity in a way, you know.
I remember watching this interview with you once, Kitten, where someone asked you which requests annoyed you the most, and you said Frank Sinatra.
Of course, still now. It's we, of course, everybody dreams to write a track that stays in history, and we are very grateful for that. But we remind ourselves we are DJs. And we play what the fuck we want. And if we don't want to play this track, it's our right. We love to please people, but we also like to please ourselves. So, yeah, at the moment, we don't really play it, and it's fine.
It's funny because it kind of reminds me of the real Frank Sinatra and how he hated singing My Way. You know, everyone would ask him for it. And there are recordings where he introduces the song by saying, and of course, the time comes now for the torturous moment. Not for you, but for me. Another time he just said, I hate this song. I got it up to here with this goddamn song.
So he, you know that it's a French song.
Mm. Yes, Comme d'habitude.
Comme d'habitude.
Claude François.
Claude François, yeah. Who is not the best French singer we had, but anyway.
Well, also I think Bowie tried to like translate it, and that became Life on Mars. Or he wasn't allowed to do it, and then he wrote Life on Mars as
Life on Mars
his version of it.
Way better than Comme d'habitude. When you have a song like this, it's cool, and it's sometimes I go through different feelings with this song. Sometimes I like it and I play it in DJ set. Then sometimes I'm bored and then I like it again. It just comes and go. But for the tour we are doing now, it just doesn't fit with the set. So maybe tonight we will play. We'll see. But it doesn't really fit with the new.
It
so we
aged.
Need a, yeah, it aged. Some old tracks didn't age. Like Life on MTV, I love this song. It didn't age, I think. But Frank Sinatra really stands out sometimes in a good way and sometimes in a bad way. And I think right now, maybe we need a new version
it's
or something.
It's too much of a joke.
It's a bit too kitsch.
I remember seeing you guys at the Arvika Festival in 2002. And when I think Frank Sinatra was the last track. And when you introduced it, you said something about, you know, how fame and wealth and being rich was completely, you know, unimportant. That don't take this song at face value. And I always assumed that it was, you know, a very obvious satire.
Of course.
But it was as if when you said that, it was as if, you know, people took the song at face value. But they completely misunderstood.
But a lot of people, a lot of people took it like at the first, level.
Because they want to believe it's an odd to their own beliefs. They are too obsessed with their their obsessions to realize it's a critique, you know. And it really comes back from the time we were partying in the woods. I remember, like, it was raining, it was cold, but we were never that happy. And I imagine guys or girls in full of money somewhere and trying to party, trying with no friends, trying to pay people to party with them. And we were that where we were having fun was not in VIPs and coke. It was in a forest.
In the end, the joke was on us. Because I remember a drive when we were playing in New York from the airport to the hotel we were playing. And I was in a limo with champagne going to an hotel. And I was like, okay, this is it. I'm living not the dream, but so. But as we did this song.
You were living the nightmare. You know,
Not a nightmare, let's be honest.
It's not a prophecy, you know.
Yeah, it was a prophecy.
Paid back.
But it was not, it was okay, but it was funny. And we were aware of that, you know, as we did this song before, and then suddenly we are leaving what we were singing about, but you know what I mean. So it was a strange.
And the irony is to perform the song, like to take the piece of the actual audience who praise what we are saying against them.
It's when we were going through this
insane
phase of fame that lasted for like 15 minutes, you know. And I was very, very aware of that. And I was always thinking, I remember, enjoy, take what you can, because it won't last. And it didn't. But I was very conscious of that. So I think that's why we never got, I don't know how do you say, grosse tête in English. We never went like megalo or crazy. Because me, I was always very conscious of it won't last forever.
We never really liked that. It was never the best parties.
Oh, I liked it.
You liked it?
Yeah, it was fun. People reacting that way kind of reminds me of... I once spoke to Bret Easton Ellis, the writer, and he told me that Wall Street guys will walk up to him and go, oh, thank you for writing American Psycho. It made me want to become a stockbroker. Mm. And he's like, no, that was not the point.
Go for it. Yeah. That's what he should have said, like...
But it's this kind of situation. I said I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it because I was aware of it, of what was happening. So I didn't fall in all the traps that you can fall into when you have a little bit of success. So it was fun.
But when you first wrote the track, you didn't know that Frank Sinatra was alive.
No.
He was still alive.
He was still alive.
I just picked Frank Sinatra.
You just assumed he was dead.
Because it rhymed with Grey Area, by the way.
Yeah, it doesn't really rhyme. Well, in a French accent, it does rhyme. That's what's beautiful about the song. You know, someone like Serge Gainsbourg would be so proud of that rhyme.
Area, Sinatra.
It's like a tribute to the French language.
Yeah, it rhymes. Area, Frank Sinatra.
But he died not a long time after this song.
And I said, I fucking killed him, maybe.
But we liked him.
But I remember this song by, you remember L.A. Style, James Brown is Dead?
Of course.
Yeah.
Which came out in 1992 when James Brown was very much alive.
Can we play it now?
Let's listen to L.A. Style.
Yeah, but not the rap version.
James Brown is dead.
You've both been DJing for decades. What are your like worst memories from clubs or parties when people have been really annoying?
Must be somewhere in the 90s in the south of France, for sure. I don't know. No, worst. Sometimes you have like technical condition who are like a nightmare. Sometimes it's the people who doesn't They don't get your music, so, but I don't, I,
right now... No one has ever, like, pulled the gun on you or something like that.
Not me.
But to talk about Frank Sinatra, remember when, I just remember that now, but we played in Istanbul, and there was this gay guy, hysterical, there were a lot of hysterical gay guys who were just constantly screaming. Like you are performing, you try to focus, and you have one guy ruining your performance for like hundreds or thousands of people. And he was like, Frank Sinatra, Frank Sinatra, nonstop for like minutes. And then I stopped the music. I freaked out because I was tired. It was the end of our never-ending tour. And I went to really, I stopped the music. I went in front of him and I screamed in his face like, get the fuck out of here. And he just froze and started crying because I just scared him to death.
He was like constantly screaming.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra, Frank Sinatra. Okay, yeah, you can say non-stop. It once, two times. It was like nonstop. Even me, I was annoyed because we were playing live.
Yeah. We were playing.
And
live.
I was like, please, relax. We are going to play it.
You can't sing.
Yeah, no.
You have a guy screaming at you, like for. And sometimes, in fact, that's the most difficult thing when you're a DJ or a performer. It's to ignore the one person that wants to catch your attention, because if you surrender, he wins. And you don't pay respect to all the people.
There is always one person who doesn't like what you're doing or asking for something. And even if there is like 5,000 people, when you turn your head, you always, you know, watch this person who is annoying you. Always, always. Yeah. That's, I don't know why.
But they win if you give them attention, because basically if they are here, it's because they like your music.
Yeah.
So they use negativity to catch your attention, which is completely wrong. You just have to, sometimes when people really annoy me like this when I play, because it happens, there is always one selfish person who doesn't care about the great party you're having, just thinking about his own desire to talk to you, get a little bit of your time. I just answer, I know you exist. I know you're here. I know you exist. Calm down. I see you, you know. So,
Michelle, you were almost like a mentor to Mike Levi, Gesaffenstein. Do you still work with him?
Yeah. We are always in touch. And
it must have been like 15 or 16 when you first met.
No, it was young, but it was not that young. He was like 17, 18, something like that. And we are still in touch. We did a track together for the album he released 3 or 4 years ago. And we did some tracks together a few months ago. Four tracks. We don't know what we're going to do with those tracks. But yeah, we are still in touch. And he's a friend, you know. It's not just like a friend, close friend.
Did you give him advice on how to, like, take care of his career? Because he seems to have been trying to avoid, like, extreme fame in some ways.
I don't know. It's not really advice. Is we talk about it, and I know. I don't know if he doesn't really listen to anybody, but he always asks me, "What do you think of that?" And then he made his own decision. But now he's doing his own thing, you know. But he's a nice guy, and he's very clever, very smart. So I'm not worried for him.
I remember I once went to see him DJ, and he put on your great track Flesh and Bone halfway through the set, and everyone just went crazy.
It's a good track.
Do you still play it live with you on vocals? Because that worked really well.
Not this time, but
that's maybe. That's a good... we didn't think about it, actually. Maybe later, why not?
We still have the live version.
The lyrics are complicated to remember.
It took me a lot of time to do this song right. Mm. And also because Perspect is doing it so well.
Yeah, Jan Clark, who wrote the original lyrics and sang it.
I had to sing one octave higher.
Yeah,
because it's very
but
low.
But maybe we could do it. Yeah.
How did you write the lyrics for your track "Rip and Kitten" that you did with Golden Boy? They were inspired by the Misfits, right?
By a sticker of the Misfits that my Finnish from Finland, my cousin. My metal punk cousin from Finland offered me, yes.
So their track was called "Mommy, Can I Go Out and Kill Tonight?" And you sang "Daddy, Can I Go Out and Kill Tonight?" Did the Misfits or even Glenn Danzig himself react to your song in any way?
No. It's never. And it's just the line is great. But I somehow I stole a lot of lines to other people and transformed it. Like, for example, this other track, Requiem for a Hit, I Beat That Bitch with a Hit. It's stolen from Johnny Dangerous, I Beat That Bitch with a Bat. And I know he was very upset that I stole his line. But I'm a woman, fuck you. You know? You cannot say I beat that bitch with a bat like a fun thing. I have the right to use your fucking line and turn it into something, and I'm not giving you money for that. You know, so at the time I felt really guilty, and then with time I realized that it was well deserved. So you always get inspired by someone. But then the great thing is, can you take it further? Can you bring it to something else, your thing? This is music, this is art, we all do that. Michelle get inspired by people, a note, a sample from somebody. So yeah, it happens to me too.
But yeah, April 14 from Aphex Twin, as it is today or yesterday, I don't know.
It is April 14th.
Today, so that's the right track.
It's like necessary. It's a necessary artist and necessary music in our life. We can't live without.
Talking about, just before we were talking about, you know, inspiration and things like that. And on my phone, I listen to music on my phone now when I travel and blah, blah, blah. And I have all the, it's funny, in my phone, I have the albums that I have at home on tape. Records, CD, and digital, you know, I buy them like in all formats anyway. And so I have the Polygon Window, Something on Sinewave.
Which was one of Aphex Twin's pseudonyms.
One of the first on WAP. And I was listening to this album 2 weeks ago, and I was like, wow, I stole everything. I mean, I can recognize every tracks, this and this influenced me for this track. So it's it's a very, especially this album for me is very important. And it didn't age. It's from 91, 92, and you can still listen to this day, and it's good. You know.
Speaking of classics, how much do you listen to the songs that you mention in your famous track 1982?
Not so much anymore because it's big hits, you know.
The really big hits, right? Yeah, Don't Go, Just Can't Get Enough. Yeah.
Actually, it's the only song where we wrote lyrics together. Mm. But all the songs, of course, are great. But I don't really listen to those songs anymore because it's everywhere on the radio, blah, blah, blah. But it's good songs, of course.
I remember dancing to that song when you played in Arvika in 2002. Yeah. And then I listened to the same track like just a few days ago, and it was such a, you know, mindfuck because I realized that 2002 is as far back now as 1982 was in 2002.
It's true.
1982 is 40 years ago.
And
I felt this tremendous like fear of aging and death and everything.
You can't escape it. I'm turning 50 at the end of the year.
So am I.
What happened? What happened? You know.
Yeah, you're just starting your dancing, prochaine. And then all of a sudden you're at 50.
This year, 2022. Yeah, 22. I'm 50 in December.
Oh. Which day in December are you born?
21st.
I'm born on the 22nd of December, 1972.
So I'm older than you one day.
Crazy. That's insane.
What plans do you have for this year?
My most urgent plan is to succeed in finding the rhythm that fits to me. Because before COVID, we were really busy solo. COVID, there was nothing. And I think our album and this project really kept me going and gave me hope. And now we are back into a heavy schedule. But my life has changed. You know, I love my life during the week. I have many things to do, like take care of a house. And if I don't have these days at home to do what I have to do, this rich private life, I won't be able to keep the rhythm to deliver good performances. So the goal is to continue play great sets with Michel, like we have great gigs, and keep my weeks at home for my real life, in a way. That's really my goal.
I thought by rhythm that you meant like which BPM fits you the best, because I just discovered the other day that my favorite rhythm, my favorite BPM is 100.
Wow.
It's pretty slow, yeah. But I listened to this Ukrainian techno producer called Ship Her Son. And he did a track called Gott, like God in German.
Mm.
Which is, I'll play it.
That was cool, but we really have to go. Sorry.
I'm so happy to have had you here. Thank you so much for coming over.
Thank you.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for all your great songs.
Thank you.